The following is an unrehearsed interview by John Clee with Mr. Ira Massey for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview is being conducted at Maysville Community College on July 17th, 1985. Let's begin and tell me a little bit about your family background, your parents, where you were born.
John, I was born in Scott County on November the 13th, 1919, of parents who had just recently married about 10 months before, and they both were quite young. My mother was 16 when I was born, and my dad was 19.
I see.
And we moved to Owen County shortly after that in Kentucky, where we operated on a small farm, a blind man's farm, would you believe, as a tenant. And so we lived on that farm for about all 6-7 years before my dad decided, hey, I want a farm of my own.
I see.
So he bought a little farm in Scott County, and we moved back to Scott County then.
What about brothers and sisters? Do you have any siblings?
I had three brothers, all younger than I, of course. Yes, I was the oldest. And we were spread out about 4 years apart. And my being the oldest, of course, I always felt like that, what would you say, that I shared the brunt of the whole thing, because long about the time that I was big enough to go to the field and work, the Depression set in. And believe you me, we had to work because we were buying farms and my brothers were coming on, and we needed to survive, and we really had to dig and dig and dig. And so I worked hard while I was a youngster.
Let's talk about your father's struggle to get his own farm. Now, tenant farmers used to be something that was just as common as anything, and today it's really dropped a lot. Did he talk much? Were you old enough when he was a tenant, or did he buy the farm when you were relatively young?
I really was not old enough to know what he thought about a tenant and being a tenant on a farm in Owen County. However, as I grew up and as we talked about farming, I was he left no doubt in my mind but what he did not want to be a tenant. And my dad was a very strong man, and he did not want anybody telling him that he had to do this and he had to do that. So the only way he could get away with that is to buy a place of his own. Now, you know, well, most of us that were born in that era realizes that there simply was not any money in anything. And so he didn't have enough money to buy this farm, but he borrowed I think $100 from his sister as down payment, and bought a little 90-acre farm, I think, for about $1,000, and we went farming. That's the way we started.
Yeah. It's interesting. My dad was born about the same time as you, and he said, he kind of tells a similar story, that when they bought that farm in the Depression, it made things even worse.
It did.
Because it was harder to make those payments.
Yes. I quite well remember. Of course, I was 8, 9, 10 years old at that time, you see.
Yes, sir.
And I quite well remember how difficult it was for us to make a payment and then buy enough necessary items that we needed to survive. Because I'm not sure that we could survive the day like we did then. We didn't have any electricity. We didn't have any water in the house. We had to carry water for, it seemed like to me, a half a mile, and no telephone, and it was difficult. It was difficult in those days. Of course, we didn't need a lot of money, but it was difficult to survive.
What do you think from your father was the some of the qualities that you obtained from him? Hard work, maybe?
Oh, yeah, hard work, but I think more than anything else, a dominant sort of characteristic. In other words, he was not an individual that, if you met him and talked with him, you'd say, well, here's a real easygoing man. You could get along with him, you could agree with him, and that's right. You could agree as long as you would agree halfway with him. But if you tried to take advantage of him or anything like that, he soon got up on his hind heels. I think strength of character is the way that I would say it more than anything else. Surely he wanted work. Many, many times I've gotten up at 3 o'clock in the morning and milked 8 cows and got the horses up and geared them, had breakfast, and then go to the field and sit down and wait until it got light enough to go to work in the field. Many a time I have done that, so no question about He was exemplified in hard work, but I think that strength of character had more to do with our area of family living than anything else.
You mentioned your father and, you know, the kinds of things that he emphasized, but obviously in that kind of setting, your mother had a very difficult time and a big job.
Yes, she did. She totally different from what women are today and totally different from what I've got, because she was a lady of the old school.
Yes, sir.
She believed in serving the family, almost worshiping the family, a little more so than I think she should. For example, when I entered high school, I had a clean white shirt every day ironed for me to wear to school. Well, that was unnecessary, but that was the way that she showed her love to the family, and I think she worshiped my dad, is the only way that I can put it, and they had their differences, of course, but the final say was my dad, and this is the strength of character I think I got from my family.
Now you mentioned taking care of the cattle and getting a team of horses ready for work. What about, one of the things I think that has changed is that that farm that you lived on as a child was probably a diversified operation, wasn't it?
Very much so. Very much so.
Tell me about that. What kinds of things did you do on that?
We had the cows, or the cattle, that I mentioned first, because today, I wonder if we'll make as many mistakes in the next 30 years as we've made in the last 30 years, because we're just now getting around to crossbreeding in cattle.
Yes, sir.
Well, my dad, that's the only way he'd have it. And of course, a lot of people laughed at us back in those days. Crossbreeding? Well, I never heard of such a thing, but that's the only way he'd have it. So he had good milk cows, and he covered them with big, good Hereford bulls. And he got a good crossbred calf, and it topped the market every year. So we had milk cows, we milked the milk, we strained the milk, we sold cream. That was the way we literally survived. We sold cream once a week. That meant we got to go to town once a week, too, when we had the cream. So we had 5 to 10 gallons of cream every week. Now, that was our mainstay. But our tobacco, back in those days, we were getting 8-10 cents a pound. And that didn't bring you much money. But we'd have 5, 6, 7 acres of tobacco. We'd have about 15-18 acres of corn. And our payday in May, believe it or not, was sheep. We had 2 flocks of sheep, and we really did feel that sheep was our savior, because when we needed to pay off a note, when we needed to pay for something that we let drag along, when we sold those spring lambs, that's when we paid the bill. But the rest of the diversification, we lived off of that, and so that's about the way we survived on that little diversified farm. We had 3 of them. We finally got together 3 farms. We managed 2 others, and this classified us, I guess, into a medium-sized operation.
Now, one of the things on a diversified farm, and this is one of the things that I've been interviewing a lot of different kinds of people, and tobacco is such a mainstay today, it's hard to understand how we can do without it. But it sounds like in the 1920s, it was not a very important part of the whole operation to begin with.
That's right. We had tobacco every year. And if we didn't make much money out of tobacco last year, well, we'd do it increase, produce more next year. Now, that's not a good theory to operate on, but that's the way we operated in the 20s and 30s. But tobacco was not a mainstay on our operation. It was part of our operation. And this is a thing that we have difficulty understanding today, because the price of tobacco has been fairly good to us. When we went on the government program back in the 40s, the price got up fairly good, and so we've become almost depending on it and nothing else. But back in those days, we could not depend on it, because there were times when you would owe the warehouseman funds for selling your tobacco. And many a time during those periods, I have watched them operate and say, well, I'll pay you next year, or I'll bring in some chickens, or I'll bring you a ham, or something like that, just to pay for selling his tobacco, because there's no money in it at all. And
they
didn't get enough to pay
the warehouse.
No, they did not get enough to pay the warehouse costs. That's right. And so we didn't depend on it that much. We we really depended on that cream. That was wheat. Of course, my mother saved eggs. We had a little small flock of chickens, and she saved eggs. And sheep. If it hadn't been for the sheep,
yeah,
we'd have been in that day, in that era, sheep was as important to us as tobacco is today.
Was that mostly from the wool? Is that what people were using?
And no, lambs. Lambs are the big things. Those spring lambs that we sold in tremendous demand by the New York people.
Uh-huh.
They liked Kentucky spring lambs.
Kentucky spring.
And we could sell spring lambs when we couldn't sell anything else.
I see.
And so it was a real profit-making enterprise for us. Now, wool helped, yes.
Yeah.
But there was as much work or more in getting wool than the returns.
Yeah.
But we had to get the wool off of the
sure.
yows. So we did shear them and took care of the wool and sold it. But the spring lambs was
that
a big
income.
That was the delicacy of it. That's right.
Another thing that I found, too, is that with tobacco bringing on an increased importance, that the seasons kind of gotten concentrated. Now, when you were... when you were growing tobacco as a youth with your father, didn't that stretch out an awful long period, longer than it does today? For example, you know, selling and stripping might be early or later in the year, wouldn't it?
Very much so. But many times we would not get our crop prepared
mm-hmm.
to go to the market until late January or February because we had so many other things to do on the farm. Remember, I said we had 15, 18, 20 acres of corn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this meant that you had to cut the corn, shock the corn, and then go back and even in bad weather and shuck that corn out and take it to the crib.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a total different operation from what it is today. So we spread out the workload from, it seemed to me, from daylight to dark and from January 1 to December the 31st because there was always something to do on the farm.
Mm-hmm. So the you just didn't have time to get out there and do everything. That you had to get that corn in, and that was all hand labor.
All hand labor. Everything was hand labor in those days because you had a disc car and a slide and a wagon and a raster's plow and two horses and a strong back and a weak mind. And that's the only way you could farm in those days.
Well, that's what I kind of want to go into now a little bit is just – ask you a few questions and take me through a tobacco season in the 1920s, maybe, and how the work was done maybe differently as a youth. For example, one of the first things you do is you have to prepare the beds.
That's right.
Now, of course, now we can spray and do those kind of things, but now what was preparing beds like then?
Preparing beds in those days was that you cut the wood to burn a bed in the fall of the year, and then along about March 1 to March 15, sometime during March, you would, or any good day that you could find when the soil was dry enough,
mm-hmm.
you'd go burn the tobacco beds. And this was anywhere from 2 to 3 days long to get 2 or 3 beds burned.
Mm-hmm.
And what about
selection of those beds at that time?
We didn't pay much attention to that in those days. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know why, because it was very important. It was as important then as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't pay that much attention. We'd plow the beds, have them near the field in which we were going to grow it, and then we'd turn around and burn it. And there's a lot of little silly things that we could have done better,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't know about in those days.
Now, burning the bed, the purpose of that was to keep the weeds down.
That's right.
Now, how did tobacco seed is an amazing...
Oh, we saved that from the year before, you see. We would select. Usually my dad would do this, but occasionally I could have some impact on what plants he saved.
Uh-huh.
And we would save 3, 4, 5 plants, and then we'd cut the seed head off just before frost,
mm-hmm.
take them in and turn them upside down and hang them up in the crib and let them dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime over the Christmas holidays usually, we'd take those seed heads and mash them out,
uh-huh.
clean, blow it out, blow the chaff out, and then we'd have seed there. And I don't ever remember us pre-germinating those seed. And if you look back in the history, you'll find that nearly all of our beds were overseeded, put too many seeds on them.
Mm-hmm.
and our plants would be very poor at the time we got ready to transplant tobacco. But I don't ever remember us pre-germinating them to see whether we had 70, 80, or 90% germination. And therefore, we had difficulty in judging how many seed to put on a bed. But that was standard in those days. We did not have any seedsmen. As a matter of fact, we didn't have any seedsmen as we know them today until about 1937. They produced one of our Kentucky 16 varieties in 1936 and then sold a seed in 37. I should preface that with, we had some people that were saving their type of tobacco and selling it, such as Judy's Pride, mm-hmm. Kelly's, Barnett Special, all sorts of names that was used. And these seed would be of a name that they saved the seed on the farm and sold it. Now, there was no certification, there was no identification, there was no official thing about this. It's just a man decided, hey, I'm going to save a half acre of seed and sell those seed next year. And that's what he did. But we saved our own. We never would buy those. We'd save our own.
And was there any science to that? Would you look at a plant and try to save your best plants? Or?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We made quite a science of that in selecting the type of plant that we wanted the following year. And we look for uniformity, we look for size, we look for number of leaves per plant, we look for how well those leaves filled out back on the internodes, you know, so we could get that yield. In those days, we were getting all of 1,000 to 1,200 pounds to the acre. Uh-huh. And the only way we could increase our poundage was to make sure that our variety that we saved was the best that we knew how to select. So yes, we made quite a science out of that.
Would neighbors exchange?
Seldom, seldom. Sometimes when you develop such a good type of tobacco, that's how these fellows that I mentioned a minute ago, Barnett Special, that's how they got into the seed business, because people looked at their crops and said, hey, you got a pretty good crop. Let me buy some of your seed next year. And so that would happen. Now, we never did attempt to do anything like that. I really don't know why, because our crop was as good, if not better, than anybody else's, and we could have done it, but we didn't try.
Yeah. Now, one of the things about tobacco seed, the uninitiated, I guess, don't know, is there's a tremendous amount of seed in a small amount. How did you get that? How did you all use? How did you get that uniformly spread? Did you mix it with ashes?
We mixed it with ashes. Uh-huh. That's the way we got it out. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, we would just put dirt into the pan that we mixed up. But most of the time, it's just plain old wood ashes that was left there on the bed after we burned it and mix it up and get enough body in it so that we could get good distribution. So we had no problem there.
Yeah.
Our problem was we always put too many seed on the bed.
And the plants would choke themselves
out? Too thick, very thick, yeah, and very small stem. And just did not have good livability when we transferred them from the bed to the field. I remember this, when we transferred them out of the bed, we again had that strong back and weak mind, because we waited until a season, until it rained. And then we took our fingers and made a hole and put the plant in the hole and then pushed the dirt back to it. So you had to have a good plant if you were going to get him growing, because first thing you had compacted soil.
Yeah.
Second thing, you could break that plant often when you were doing that, because he's very fragile, you see. Mm-hmm. You could break it. And a third, you were compacting the soil all around, because you had a lot of people in the field and the soil was still wet. So you had lots of difficulty in transferring the plants from the bed to the field.
I see. Now those seed beds, and I want to get into the setting here in a minute, the seed beds themselves, more weeding involved, I guess, then.
Oh, yes. We'd weed our beds two and three times because, remember, we did not have this clean mowing like we have today.
Mm-hmm.
We had lots of growth, lots of weeds. It was difficult to find any area that was clean.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a million seed in a small area, and you kill 90% and you leave 10%, you're still leaving a lot of weeds. And that's what we did in those days. We just simply could not. Weeding the bed was one of the most difficult jobs I think I've ever had. in my early days when I started in tobacco work, I had a young economist to say to me, the first thing you want to do when you get ready to weed a tobacco bed is to get into a comfortable position. Now, I've looked for that position for all these many years, and I haven't found it yet. So it was difficult for me when I was on the farm to weed a tobacco bed, and usually we'd do it three times.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings up the idea that this required a lot more labor at that time. Of course, you don't see anybody much doing that anymore.
Seldom have to,
yeah,
because we're so, I'd say, expert in using chemicals and in techniques that now are getting the job done for us. But we were not in those days. Surely we've improved a great deal.
Okay. Talking about setting tobacco now, it's kind of interesting. It sounds like on your farm then, somebody might be, or you might, your family might still be engaged in farming in that area. And you might not have as much land in cultivation today as you did then, maybe.
Oh, that's right. We would not have, not today. You see, tobacco, if we grew 7 acres in those days, we'd be down to less than an acre today because of our yields and because of our Disappearance Act and because of our imports. So that's right, we'd have less. We'd have less corn because we wouldn't have that need for it. We cannot produce corn here in our belt as cheaply as they can back in the big corn belt. So you're almost forced to buy. Now, back in those days, we couldn't have bought it because we didn't have the money. We didn't have any cash. And so we operated more on a barter system in those days than we did on a cash.
Okay, well, we're talking about, say you're ready to transplant now. Was that pulling plants, of course, that was a labor-intensive thing. You just go out there and pull them.
You better believe it.
How did you get that tobacco field prepared? What did you have to do to it?
Well, I think that the majority of ways, now a minute ago we talked about setting tobacco on a season, and we did a lot of that, but I think more in those days we used a hand jobber.
Well, you might have mentioned what a season meant, but people that don't know, it had to rain the night.
That had to rain the night before, and the soil had to be in the right condition before you could take plants and transfer them into the field. If it's too wet, then you ran into a lot of trouble. If it's too dry, the plants wouldn't live. Mm-hmm. So you had to have the soil just right. And that's why I say the majority of times I think we used a hand jobber. Mm-hmm. Now, a hand jobber takes two people, one to handle it and one to drop a plant into it. And usually my job was to handle the jobber, and then I'd have somebody, one of my brothers, dropping a plant in it. And then Mom and one of the little boys would be pulling plants at the bed. And my dad would be laying off and supervising and seeing that everything was going right. And so that's the way that we'd usually transplant tobacco in the spring of the year.
Now, when you're using one of those jobbers, that would punch the hole.
That's right.
And the plant would drop in the hole. Was there any water?
Oh, yes.
The jobber had water attached.
That's right. You had to have water. That's right. We had to have another man in the field carrying water to us.
Keeping that thing filled up.
Keeping that thing filled up. It'd hold, I guess, maybe 2 gallon at most. And you would punch it into the ground, and then you'd drop the plant in it, and then I would squirt a little water on it through a trigger on my handles, and then I'd open the jaws up and lift it up, and then drag my heel, dragging the dirt to the plant, and move on to the next one. And that you could... you could get pretty good at it, and we could move across that field in a hurry. But, boy, it's hard work.
That's particularly when you're talking about 5 or 6 acres.
That's right.
7 acres.
That's
like that.
Right. You'd be setting tobacco for, a good 3 weeks to a month anyway.
Gee.
Yeah, because you just didn't have the manpower to hurry it up and get it done any faster.
Now, when would that start? What time of year would you start?
Whenever you could get those plants coming off, and usually would start the same time we do now, May 20, May 25, and then we'd set right on up till almost July 1.
So that, again, there's another example where it stretched out that season. Because then
today, 20 acres, it takes us about 3 days.
Yeah.
Back in those days, 5 acres, we'd set for a month on it. That's right. That's the speed, and that's the changes that have taken place over the years. Yeah.
Now, your father would line it up. That means he'd be setting the rows.
That's right. He'd take one of our horses, old Mabel, I call her, he'd take her with a jump type plow.
What's
and lay it off. This is a plow that's just got one plate on it.
I see.
And he'd send that plate down in the soil, maybe 6 or 7 inches, and he'd roll up a furrow. Uh-huh. And that furrow is the one that we would set our tobacco on. Uh-huh. And he'd take this and lay it off, and he'd get the field laid off into rows that were, 38 to 40 inches wide. Uh-huh. And then we'd come along and put plants in that row every 18 to 20 inches. But now remember, we'd put it up on the fur and not down in the fur that was made. Because the loose soil, you see, when we send that plate through the soil, uh-huh, we would roll dirt up on a little ridge like.
Yes, sir.
And we'd come along and set our plants on that fur because we had more loose soil there than we would down in the fur.
Yeah, easier. And the plant, of course, could work in that looser soil.
That's right. That's right.
And he just had to do that by sight.
Just by sight.
Just set those rows.
That's right. Just by sight.
I've been told by other farmers that, you know, of course, lived in this time period about that was kind of a source of pride for farmers to have straight rows. And
well, very much pride. As a matter of fact, they bragged on it. Go to town on Saturday and talk about how good John's field looks down here because all the rows are just as straight as a bullet.
Yeah.
And you could often hear that. And then there. Back in those days, they were proud of uniformity, too, getting the field up and having uniformity in size.
Oh, I
and
see.
That
it
was
plant.
Another. Yeah, each plant be of the same size. See, that was another bragging point, too. Mm-hmm. We bragged a lot more in the old days than we do now. Of course, we don't have much time today to talk to each other.
Yeah.
We're always on the go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, as you were setting these with the jobber, too, that was just beside.
That's right.
So you had
that's
to
right.
just kind of fudge that 18 to 20 inches.
That's right. You would fudge is a good word. I guess guess or uh-huh. after you've done it a while, you know to pick it up and put it down. Almost it's instinct more than it is anything
maybe
else.
The rhythm, maybe.
It's a rhythm.
Uh-huh.
It's a rhythm that you develop into after a couple of rows.
Yeah.
And you stay there in that position for the whole day, you see. You're bent over, you're stooped over, mm-hmm. because you're looking into the soil all day. And you can get a lot of tobacco put out.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I've been told, too, that sometimes farmers didn't take as much regard for erosion and some of those kind of things. Were they concerned that sometimes they just wanted those rows to be straight and they'd go through valleys and sometimes it would wash or...
I suppose that's right on a lot of people's farm. That was never true on a place that we lived.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, being a youngster and having all the work I had to do, I didn't have much time to look at what others were doing.
Yes, sir.
But we were always concerned about erosion, and we tried to follow the contour of the land. Now, occasionally, and as I remember back, we would plow up diversion ditches that should have been left in grass.
Oh, I see.
And that's a mistake that we made. But remember, knowledge was not very uh-huh. prolific in those days.
But that showed a concern that you were trying
very
to
much concern. Yeah, very much concerned because mm-hmm. we realized that if we lost the soil, and we didn't have much. Remember, I'm from the hills. I didn't mention that. Uh-huh. I've got one leg shorter than the other one, so I'm from the hills. And we were very much concerned about maintaining the soil and maintaining good fertility because that was on our minds constantly.
Now tell me, the fields that you chose for tobacco, did you try to alternate the fields? Would you go back to the same field?
No, we'd alternate the fields. Mm-hmm. We only had about, I'd guess 7 or 8 fields that we could use. Mm-hmm. And these were all the best fields on these farms that we had. Mm-hmm. And they were usually the bottom fields. Now, occasionally we'd have to go up on the hill because in our rotation system, we wouldn't have enough land to do it. So occasionally we'd have to go up on the hill. But generally, we would rotate and we would stay in the very best land we had and in the bottom land at that.
Well, that reveals a lot about, I think, tobacco in Kentucky, that we only have a limited amount of property.
Right.
And you wanted to utilize that the best way you can.
Well, you see, right now we're only occupying about 0.2% of our agricultural land. And even back in those days, the figure was often quoted that we've never used more than 1% of our agricultural land, and I'm talking about land that is capable of producing crops. I'm not talking about our forest and upland. I'm talking about the capability of producing crops. So tobacco has never occupied a large percentage of our agricultural land. It's always been very small.
After the plant was out there in the field, a man that had several boys like yourself probably put hose in your hand and had you working.
Well, my dad was always of the opinion that if he couldn't find you something to do, he'd have you go out here and pick up these rocks and throw them over the fence and then go back over the, get them on the other side and throw them back on the other side. We always had grubbing to do, and we had fields to clean up.
I had two of a tape with Ira Massey. You were talking about ever keeping busy, that you were kept busy.
That's right. There was always something to do, but we would chop the weeds out of the tobacco. We hoed tobacco in those days. Mm-hmm. And as I look back over the culture that I was taught on the farm, why we did that, I don't know, because we could see that tobacco really didn't need it. But the custom was, and we're great people to follow custom. The custom was to hoe that tobacco, to pull dirt to it. And my dad believed in that. So having four boys around, yes, sir, that's one of the things that we'd have to do. About 2 to 3 weeks after that tobacco was out, we'd have to get out there with a hoe and chop all the weeds out of it and pull dirt to each a plant. And we call that hoeing. Mm-hmm. And quite often we'd get into fields that had a lot of crabgrass in it, and we just almost have to skin the ground to clean it up and to pull dirt into it. So there's a lot of work in growing it, that's right.
Now, you all used animals at that time in your cultivation.
Yes.
After the plant was out, could you get in there with a horse?
Oh, yes, we had two of them. We had two horses, and they were just as careful as they could be not to step on a tobacco plant, because they knew what would happen if they did. And they were just like a young boy, that if a young boy goes out and tears up something, he can expect to get a thrashing the next morning. And we always knew that would take place. So we had two horses and a Rastus plow.
Now what's that?
A Rastus plow was a two-plated plow in which the left plate would really go down deep and kind of stir up the soil. Uh-huh. And what we call it, plowing it hard. Mm-hmm. And we'd go in there and plow that tobacco. We had to in those days, because our fields were so dirty weed wise
yes, sir,
that we had to do a lot of plowing, and we'd plow three and four and five times just to keep the weeds down. And so we had two horses that was real good at that, and even I as a young boy could take these horses, and they'd follow me just as good as they would my dad.
That wasn't as much from your skill as their skill.
That's right. Right. They're the ones that had the skill. Uh-huh. Now, they were taught to go slow and give me time to guide that plow and put that plow where it needed. And on some people's farm, they got so good, and I never did do this, but they got so good that they could weave in and out of those plants and literally plow between row, if you get what I mean. If it's every 18 inches, you come in here and take that plate and just keep it running around like that, and you weave enough that you plow between the row. And so, as I say, we never did get that proficient, but some people could do it.
Now, were you still on the farm when machinery was introduced?
No. You see, I left the farm in 1939, and I was, when I had to sucker tobacco, and of course, we didn't get that far along in our discussion.
Yeah,
When I had to sucker tobacco, uh-huh, I was always tall, 6'4". And when I had to sucker tobacco on the bottom leaves, that nearly killed me. Uh-huh. And along about 1938, early in 39, when I decided there had to be something else in this world besides growing tobacco. So I... right at that time, we were having a lot of problems worldwide. And I went to work in Georgetown for a short while, but I realized I needed to get out and see what was going on in the world. So would you believe, as a 19-year-old, I joined the U.S. Marine Corps, and I found out in a hurry what the world was like.
Well, I want to get up to that, but I want to go back and talk about the next job in the tobacco field
would be the hand suckering.
We'll start right there then and talk about that hand suckering again.
That hand suckering, yeah. I can talk for a week about hand suckering, because that's the most difficult job that I remember on the farm, because always being around 6 foot four, and we suckered tobacco three times every season. And along about 1938 or 39, I decided on the third time through the field that there had to be another way to make a living than growing tobacco. So I looked for it. But at any rate, we'd top the tobacco, and I don't really remember what stage of bloom it would top it, but we'd top it, clean up the suckers that were in it, and then go back through it about 2 weeks later and get the suckers again. And then 2 weeks to a month later, we'd go back in and hand sucker it again, and then cut it just before they started growing again. And the reason why we let the suckers grow is this produced, we thought, more leaf, and produced a type of leaf that companies were buying.
Now, what were they looking for then?
Well, they were looking for, back in those days, more of what they are right today, but they wanted color in it. They wanted a good, long, high aroma taste type of tobacco. They wanted it to be reasonably high in nicotine. They wanted a leaf that was solid. And they wanted it so that it would grade maybe a C4F. I know a lot of people don't know what that is, C3F. But this is a lug. It's the longest and it's the widest and it's got the most aroma in it. Got the most taste in it of any leaf on the stalk.
Now, where does that come on?
That
on
comes
on
about
stark or
eight leaves up from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
The first few leaves that we have on the bottom is called trash or flyings, and they're the oldest, and they've been weather beaten, and they're just not solid. They're trashy, and then the next group of leaves is lugs, and back in those days, that's what they were buying. Don't really think they wanted it, because you know, after the war, they started going to low nicotine, low quality tobacco, and producing a lighter, thin smoke. But back in those days, we smoked Philip Mars and Chesterfields and Campbell's and Lucky Strikes, and that's all we had, about five brands. And so they did use real fine tobacco in those five brands.
Now, at that time, they were buying, there was an American blend cigarette.
That's right.
A blended cigarette. There wasn't very much of this tobacco going to plug and cigars and those kind of things.
More than you would think. Back in those days, cigars, particularly if they got it cheap enough, they would buy it and put it in their cigars. They'd put it in pipe tobacco. Big use in pipe tobacco, because we were big pipe smokers back in those days, because it was cheap. Now, another thing where we lost out was in sack tobacco. Now, sack tobacco. Roll your own.
Oh,
have you ever
okay,
heard of
yeah.
that? Roll
oh, yeah,
your own.
Yeah.
Well, back in those days, we called it sack tobacco.
Yeah,
and buy a sack of Golden Grain or Run Johnny Run or Bull Durham, and we boys could ride a horse and hold the reins in one hand while we rolled a cigarette in the other hand, riding that horse at full gallop. And so you developed, we didn't have money to buy ready-made pack cigarettes, so we'd buy a nickel sack of tobacco, and that would last us for 2 weeks.
And the papers, I guess you didn't
and
have
a, oh, yeah, you had to have that.
Have
the papers, yeah, that'd go with. But we didn't get much of our burley tobacco in that type of cigarettes. No, we didn't. We went cigars, pipe, cigarettes. Those are the three big users back in those days.
Yeah. Let me get you back to the field. We talked about splitting tobacco, which is different than they do today.
Surely is. It's different. Totally different than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would top it, of course, and sucker it. We've talked about that. And then we would have a knife made specially for splitting a stalk. And that knife usually was made out of a saw blade, and it would put a rod on it, and then we'd have a handle on it. Just a piece of wood is all it was, but we'd call it a handle. And that knife, if you sharpened it properly and got to knowing how to handle it, you start that blade in the top of that stalk, and it would follow that stalk right down as far as you wanted it to go, and then you'd pull it out and cut it off at the bottom. But if you got a knife that you couldn't handle very good, and it would slip out on you and cut the stalk off, you were in a mess of trouble then, because there's no way that you could get it on a stick, you see. So you had to develop a technique of knowing the type of blade that you were using so that you could get a good split on that stalk, and you'd want it right in the center from top to bottom, and then spread it over a stalk and take it to barn.
There wasn't a problem when you stacked that on the wagon and so forth?
No.
Those plants falling
off? You'd lose a few, but not really. You handled it. You really handled it more careful in those days than you do now. Because you didn't want that tear in it. You didn't want a lot of trash. You didn't want a lot of injury in it, because it docked you. Remember, we didn't have any grades. We didn't have any system to tell us how much we were going to get. We had to have quality tobacco. And if you didn't have it, handle it carefully, you wouldn't have that.
Well, since they weren't operating on acreage or poundage or anything like that, you all had to be careful about every leaf, probably.
Every leaf. As a matter of fact, we threw away more tobacco in those days than a lot of people would even consider today, because it just did not have the quality to take to market. And not only that, but we'd make as many as 12 or 15 different grades, where we make maybe one, two, or three today. So it took us much longer in the stripping room to prepare a crop. And it had to be fixed up right, otherwise it wouldn't buy.
Well, now, the reason you threw maybe some away is because they would kind of give you a price for the whole crop?
No. Each basket on its own. In the warehouse, many of us criticize the warehouse today because they are operating almost identically to what they were operating around the turn of the century. And they've made no progress whatsoever, and that's a shame. Mm-hmm. So the warehousemen would operate the same, and a basket of tobacco would bring so much depending upon the bidders that you had bidding on that tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
No grade, no support,
nobody
had anything to do with it except those buyers that's standing around that basket of tobacco, and they determined your price.
I'll get back to that. I want to talk about that curing out process in the barn. You said that we, because the leaf with that split stalk would sometimes cure out very quickly, you needed to use fire.
Not only that, it would cure out more quickly than today's harvested tobacco, and it would come in case and rot faster than today's tobacco too, because it was so absorbent. So we had to be more critical in those days toward opening our barns and closing our barns or putting fires in our barn than we do today. Now, I would first say that today we've had climatic condition changes, and so that has had a tremendous impact on it. I would say second impact on us is that we're not as interested in the quality aspects today as we were in those days. So we're not as critical of that barn operation. And then thirdly, back in those days, our tobacco was so absorbent that it would come in case and stay in case for long periods of time, and we get rotting that would take place in the barn called house burn or pole rot. And therefore, we had to put some fires under that tobacco to drive out the moisture and to warm that barn down to keep it from further deteriorating. That's the reason why we used fires in the barn. Now, if our tobacco was curing too fast, what we do is close up our barn and not let that water get out. So it was a management tool, just like it is today, except it's different today, that we used back in the old days.
Yeah. Now, those fires were fueled usually by coke.
By coke, nearly always, because coke was so much cheaper than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd usually run a ton of coke for an acre of tobacco. And back in those days, you could get it for $10, $12, $15 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get it even less than that if you'd take your truck and haul it. And it wasn't too expensive for you to start fires and burn them. Usually about a week's time is what you would want in the stove.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess that's another business then that kind of went by the wayside. You'd be coke dealers.
Yeah. Well, they priced themselves out of the market, and we had to quit using them. Now, I think we're a little bit smarter today in the varieties that we're growing and in the maturity that we have in going to the barn and things of this nature, so we don't have to have as much coke today as we had in the old days. And maybe we didn't have to have it then, we just thought we did.
Right.
We did a lot of things on custom.
You did say that you think barn ventilation, when they build new barns, that's an improvement too.
I think we've built much better barns today. Mm-hmm. I remember as a boy on the farm about 12 years old, my dad got sick, and we had a crew hired to build us a tobacco barn. Well, I fussed at this crew all the time about being sure that we got enough doors on ventilators so we could open and close it, and to position it in the right way so we get air drainage from this barn. I didn't know what I was talking about, but I still fussed at them
right, for
getting these things, because I knew if we didn't have it, we'd have to burn coke, and I didn't want to do that.
Sure. When that tobacco I didn't ask you about putting it up in the barn. I was told that, again, farmers were much more careful. One person told me that maybe one person would hang at a time and hang a rick. Was that a custom you followed? Or?
Not at our place, no. Mm-hmm. We'd put two or three, just about like we would today. We'd put two or three up in the barn.
Yeah.
Now, I would emphasize the fact that we were much more careful with that stick of tobacco then than we are now.
Mm-hmm.
Now we drag it over rails, and we drag it over feet, and we drag it over dirt.
Yes.
We don't pay much attention to it. But back in those days, we sold only on quality aspect, and we were as careful. We handled that tobacco just like you would a dozen eggs, and so we put it in the barn very carefully. But we'd do it about the same way we do today.
Did they have the same amount of stalks, five, six, seven stalks on a stick?
Yeah. Back in those days, we'd put a few more. Today you put five. Back in those days, we'd put six and seven, you see.
The back was a little smaller.
Yeah, much smaller.
Mm-hmm. I see. When you were time to get ready for market, that's called stripping, of course, and you mentioned that you'd strip in more grades at that time.
Oh, yeah. We'd make 12, 15 grades out of our crop. Sometimes we needed more because buyers would fuss, so we'd too much mixture in this, and they'd just walk on, you see. And you sold on the basis of a grade. And if it didn't fit their grade, if it didn't fit Camels or Lucky Strikes or Chesterfield, if it didn't fit their grades, they wouldn't buy it. They'd just walk on by.
Now, at that time, did they have these titles, these names for grades? Or did they just call it, this is trash?
Now, we called it, the first grade was Spodge.
Spodge. I've never heard that term.
I know it. That's a... Not many people have ever heard that, but back in the 20s and 30s, that's what we called the first grade.
Yes.
On the bottom was Spodge.
Uh-huh.
And then we called the second grade Cutters.
Yes, sir.
And then we called the rest of the leaves Leaf. And of course that Leaf, you could break that down into red and green and tan and all sorts of grades, all sorts of
colors.
Lengths and colors, you say. Uh-huh. But those are the grades, the terminology that we use in the stripping room. Of course, you have first, second, and third Spodge. You have first, second, and third, and fourth of Cutters.
And that's referring mostly to what, length?
Length and color and body and all sorts of classifications that you could think of a tobacco leaf. We'd have it. There would be some leaves that have a little green spot on it. Well, you'd hate to throw that away, and so you'd put that over here for this grade. Another leaf would be big and long and broad and have all the color in it that you'd want. You put that in this grade. Then if you found one a little shorter, a little bit lacking in uniformity of color, you'd put that in this grade. So you'd critically separate each one of the groups that we have on the plant.
So that's where all these 12 or 15 different things
came
in.
That's right. So
you put those in separate baskets.
Oh, yes.
Each one separate basket.
Each one of them on a separate basket. Yeah.
Bring to market.
Yeah.
Again, that kind of emphasizes this whole stretching out process. If you put the thing in the field, I guess, between May 20th and maybe July the 1st, then you were out in the field cutting that tobacco, I guess, the end of August. September.
Through September, yes. A lot of times you'd get it in the night before it frosted, sure.
So that was more of a concern than this.
Everything was drawn out.
Uh-huh.
It fell into place.
Uh-huh.
You had your corn to do, you had your sheep to take care of, you had your cows to milk, and all hay to put up. Mm-hmm. So tobacco got its turn. It didn't get the predominant
right.
care that you're giving it today, because tobacco gets first today, you see.
I see.
That was not true in our operation. Mm-hmm. We had all these things, and tobacco took its turn, just like everything else. That was a lot of work. We've already mentioned that normally you consider an average of 300 man hours per acre. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced we put 400 in it those
sure.
days. Uh-huh. And I believe today we're putting 200 in it. So it's just about double the amount of work in the old days as it is today.
Now, would you take, how did you all handle that on your farm? Did you take most of your tobacco to market at the same time?
Yes.
You did? You
yes.
Did. Uh-huh.
We were so far, see, we were about 30 miles from Lexington. And we were so far away, and you didn't worry about people stealing things in those days, because you'd have a bad character or two around in the community, but everybody watched out for them, you see, and let you know if they were coming around. So we didn't worry about things like that. We didn't worry about fire, because we didn't smoke, or we were not careless. So we would slowly but surely get our tobacco stripped. And when we got it all stripped, my dad would say, well, looks like the market is good now, and he'd take it to market and sell it. And
that's did the market vary a lot during the season?
Oh, Lord, yeah, it varied a lot. You never knew what you were going to get. And back in those days, you couldn't get unloaded maybe for a week.
Yeah.
You'd have to bunk out in some bunkhouse in Lexington and have your team out there on the street for maybe up to a week's time before you could get unloaded.
Gee.
Well, I don't know why it drives me up a wall when I think about it, because it should not have been.
All that wasted
time. Yeah, all that wasted time. Lousy, yeah. It was just carelessness on our part that we didn't change those things. Mm-hmm. But custom again, it was a great thing back in those days. Even today, we're still living on custom.
Yeah. You couldn't really predict whether you wanted to be on the first market or the middle market or anything like that.
No.
You just took your chances.
You had to rely on your warehouseman a great deal, much more than you do today. And if he was a friend of yours, he would do the best he could, which wasn't much, but he'd do the best he could. But they just slowly but surely unloaded them. And again, the warehouse was kind of like the grower. They graded it again, and they made sure that every stick and every pile was just so-so. And so they might work a day on one man's crop.
Putting it in those baskets.
Putting it in those baskets and getting it lined up right, because they knew all the rest of these sitting out here on the street would still be there, and so they'd get back to them later on.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there's a lot more art kind of involved. Art in stripping tobacco, art in preparing those baskets and hand tying that.
I have referred over my life, I guess, many, many times, tobacco is almost more an art than it is a science. Mm-hmm. Because we've been at it so long. We started, 1864 up here in Germantown, someplace around here in Mason County. And we started in 1864. We've been at it a long time. We have a tremendous custom built up. Well, we did it this way 50 years ago, and let's do it again. So it is literally more an art than it is a science.
Mm-hmm. On the warehouse floor, now, even before you got to warehousing, but this time there wasn't much pin hooking going on, was there?
Oh, yes.
Was there?
That was the big day for the pin hooker. Now, and I'm really telling you more than I really should right now, because remember, I was a youngster on the farm.
Yes, sir.
And my job was to milk cows and take care of the sheep and to do things like that, while my dad took the tobacco to market.
Oh, I see.
And so I didn't get to go to market that much.
Oh, okay.
Occasionally, if he got unloaded and come back home and then would go back to the market, I'd go with him.
Yeah.
But most of the time I was back home, because there's so much work to do, and then in school. And
I've talked to some other people, but what you could recollect from your father, would they try to catch people while they're in line to be unloaded and try to offer them a price for the crop?
Not only that, they'd come to your barn.
I see.
They'd start a good pin hooker would start when you put that tobacco in the barn, mm-hmm. and he'd come want to know what you had, what you wanted for. Mm-hmm. Then he'd come back at your stripping, and then he would catch you on the street in Lexington and look at you. Your reputation there more than anything else. If you had a reputation for a good tobacco crop, he'd come to you. And then on the warehouse floor, once you put it on the warehouse floor, he'd come to you. So the pin hooker during the 20s and 30s, and I would say during the 40s, mm-hmm. was ever present. Exactly. Now remember this, we're talking about the pin hooker, and I would guess that some people would classify him in a derogatory way. I won't, because we've got pin hookers today, but we call them dealers. See, we've got a different term for them today.
Yes, sir.
You got a pin hooker right down here in Maysville, Alec Parker,
yes.
Parker Tobacco Company. He's doing the same thing today, except on a more scientific scale, on a much larger scale, on a much more knowledgeable scale, mm-hmm. than the pin hooker did in the 20s and 30s, because he was an individual, had very little money to back him. He really didn't know tobacco that well. He didn't know what the companies wanted that well. And so he was buying based on what he thought he could do. Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Parker today is buying on based on what he knows he can do, you see.
Yeah, I see.
So you classify the two nearly together, but the science and the knowledge today is much greater than it was back in those days.
But a pinhooker, of course, a pinhooker could lose in this speculation, too.
Yes.
The barber might come out ahead.
Yeah, well, Mr. Parker can lose, too.
That's
he
true.
Did lose last year, you
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
So that's exactly right. If you were a smart trader, mm-hmm. you could hook that pinhooker quite often, and you could take him to the cleaners. But usually he was one step ahead of you, and he'd know what he was doing, and he would come out on top.
Yeah. Were there very many people that traded with the pin hooker? I guess there would be some farmers that probably just needed the money, and if he would give them money up front,
yes.
you know, without having to haul it and so forth,
yes, yes,
they'd do some dealing.
Yes, quite a few people traded with these dealers in tobacco. I'm going to call them dealers instead of pin hookers,
okay.
because pin hooker has a connotation about it that is not good, and they were reputable people. They just took advantage of you if you didn't know your business. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No,
nothing wrong
true.
With that at all.
Right.
But back in those days, they operated on all markets in all counties, and even people that were in warehouses themselves would do that.
Oh, yeah.
They do that today.
Yes, sir.
They buy tobacco today and resell it. So let's go back again. Tobacco's old, it's got a lot of custom about it, and we're doing practically the same thing today, just in a little more knowledgeable way.
Yeah. Better terms.
Better terms, that's right.
Right.
That's right.
What about the relationship between the farmer and the warehouseman? Of course, that's, a farmer can choose a warehouse and a warehouseman. How did your family choose which warehouse they deal with?
My family chose the warehouse based on what they thought was the best warehouseman would give him the best deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true with a large number of our people. Unfortunately, and it's difficult to explain that we had people that would take advantage of farmers, give them a half pint of whiskey or a pint of whiskey, or give them a hot dog and get them in, get them unloaded, and then not give them the best deal
mm-hmm.
that they could get. That happened often.
Yes,
I think that brought on the government grading. I think it brought on the more knowledgeable things that we're doing today, and we have been doing since the 40s. I think things like that brought that on. That was most unfortunate that we had that era to live with, but so did the coal people, and so did the horse people, and so did everybody else. We just didn't develop the technology as fast as we should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about the farmer and the buyer? Did you ever get to know any of the buyers or try to?
No,
yeah.
I did not.
Uh-huh.
But even today, just today, three times already today, I've had farmers chastise critically the tobacco buyers. Now, and I'm convinced that they remember what the buyers did to them in the 20s and 30s.
Is that right?
When you take your tobacco to market and you owe the warehouseman extra funds over and above what your tobacco brought, then you've got to be mad at somebody. And he's not mad at the warehouseman because he's his friend, you see.
I see.
So the next guy is the buyer.
He's often a stranger.
He's a stranger.
Yeah.
He gets to use the tobacco. He's making a big profit on me. He's driving that big black Cadillac out there with the chauffeur. And
yeah,
we see those things.
True.
And he's mad at him. And even today, we still have that animosity.
You think that's a carryover?
I think it's a carryover. It's got to be a carryover because manufacturers are doing everything that they can to give us a fair shake. Now, sure, they're going to make money because they're a big corporate structure. But I really believe that they're on the farmer's side today. Now, maybe I'm naive. Maybe I'm just hard-headed. But I believe that they are very helpful to us today. Whereas back in the old days, it was a buy it if you want it, leave it there if you don't want it, and they had control, and they took advantage of it.
Of an interview with Ira Massey conducted at Maysville Community College on July 17th, and we were just finishing up talking about the buyers and how there's this leftover animosity about buyers. I wanted to pick up a little bit more. We're talking more about your youth now and your early training, and that's where I wanted to go back to. I want to ask you a few questions about some other related areas. For example, your education. Did you go to school there in the Scott County Schools?
Yes, I did. I went to school to one teacher. I think there was 23 of us in eight grades, called the RISK, R-I-S-K, Little Red Brick Schoolhouse. As a matter of fact, I have an eighth grade diploma signed by the teacher and the superintendent of schools. And, of course, you don't find many of those around today, and I still have that diploma. And then that was in 1935 when I finished.
Uh-huh.
That fall is when we started the bus system, 1935. And they transported me by bus to Stamping Ground, Kentucky School. Uh-huh. And so I finished 4 years there at Stamping Ground, 35 through 39.
Now, as you were saying, you form some conclusions out there in the field when you're sucking tobacco.
Yes.
Everyone knows you today and knows your career a little bit about it, I suppose. During those school years, could you envision what was coming?
No, not in the slightest.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the slightest. At the school, we had all of four subjects that we could select. And
yes,
of course,
sir.
Agriculture was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did not determine that I wanted to be an agriculturalist really until I got back from the service.
I see. Uh-huh.
And I talked with my friend Ivan Jett, who is an outstanding agricultural teacher and citizen of Kentucky, and I went in and chatted with him. And
where was he at here?
Oh, he was, at that time, he was executive secretary of the Grocery Association in Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
But he's been an outstanding citizen of Kentucky, and I went in and chatted with him, and we talked about our alternatives, and then's when I made the decision that I wanted to go into agriculture. But prior to that time, as I left high school, I worked for a while in retail, and then I went into Marine Corps, and I was just a young young guy, just like everybody else. I had no idea what I wanted to do or when I wanted to do it.
During your education there in Scott County, that's such an issue today, and I kind of want to just get a little bit of your feeling. How do you feel about that education?
I'm very biased.
Uh-huh.
I'm very biased. Even though I only had a choice of four subjects, I think I had one of the best educations that was possible to get in those times, because I had loyalty, I had confidence, in my teachers. Sure, they were not as sharp as some of the teachers today, but I think we have gone completely, unequivocally overboard toward combining. And this disturbs me, and it always has, and I've been PTA member, and I've fought against that, because when you put 3,000 kids, my kids graduated at senior class of 3,000 kids. Why, there's not a single teacher that knew them. They never had a chance to play back. I thought I ran the school when I was in school. I thought I had complete control. I had more confidence than all of my kids put together, because it was small enough school. I could get involved. I was in plays. I played basketball. I helped the principal of the school. I played baseball. I played everything that there was in it, and got enough of education to survive and get by in this world. And I don't see any reason for us combining and making 3,000 pupil classes. That's unbelievable to me.
If you'll allow me, it's interesting. I've done some interviews with one of the black citizens here in the town, and he said, you know, as much as integration is a positive thing, he said one negative thing was, when we were in the black schools, we held all the leadership positions. We played on the teams, and we were the student council presidents.
Yes.
And when we were thrown in with everybody else,
they were
just facing a crowd. Right?
Yeah, they were nothing.
And I think that's an interesting point that people miss, that in those smaller schools, everybody had a chance and had leadership kinds
of
things. And,
that's right. Yeah. I don't really know what would have happened to me if I had not had that opportunity in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Because I developed that leadership there, that there's no way that my kids could have gotten any of it. Now, they may have gotten a better book learning.
Mm-hmm.
They may have gotten more data, and,
mm-hmm.
and maybe I'm sure they had better teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, they didn't enjoy their school as much as I did mine.
Are there any individuals that stand out in your mind there as kind of provided some inspiration, coaches or teachers or principals that you'd like to mention?
She only had four.
Oh, I see.
But I'd have to mention one man.
Uh-huh.
This man was the principal of our school.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Joe Sable, S-A-B-E-L. He's now deceased. He was a man that stood, I guess, about 5'8". He weighed 135 pounds. And I'm telling you, I was always big, 6'4". And we had 25 or 30 other guys just like me. But I'll tell you what, when he come down the hall, you better see 25 or 30 guys making light, getting out of the way, because he had more authority.
Uh-huh.
There's no question in my mind but what he ran that school in a dictatorial way, but yet we as students could have our way and could have our say and be a part of the leadership and be a part of the school. But he was boss. And he left no doubt about that.
Talking about your height, I guess you were quite a prospect for the basketball. And so
forth. I like to think so, but I didn't have the coach, you see.
I needed
a coach. The coach was the math teacher,
uh-huh.
and he took on coaching just as a sideline. He knew nothing about coaching. that's the difference, you see.
Sure.
If I had had a good coach, maybe I would have developed somewhat, because I was 3-4 inches taller than most people were in those days. He didn't even know how to run a play, and he didn't know. I don't ever remember him teaching me one thing in basketball while I was in school.
But you did play, mostly.
But I did play. Yeah, I played 4 years on the 18.
Yeah, I see. Let me ask you about as you were growing again in this time period between your birth and before you went to the Marine Corps. Of course, you worked long days.
Yes, sir.
Was there any entertainment, or what about social kinds of things that young people did?
Well, I had it all.
Mm-hmm.
What about social things?
Uh-huh.
My goodness, I got to go to town on Saturday. That was great. Could sit in the car and watch people go up and down the street on Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
We had plays in school.
Mm-hmm.
See, we'd have a play twice a year,
and
I'd get involved with that.
I see.
Then we had basketball games, and they were twice a week, and you had practice twice a week. What else would I do? there just seemed to be something constantly going on, of which I was a part. Mm-hmm. And my kids never were in a play, never played football, never played basketball, never did anything outside of just taking their four or five courses.
Well,
and that's what I object to.
Yeah, 3,000 kids, there's only going to be 10 on the basketball
team. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it does make it difficult.
So we had social activity. Of course, don't forget dates. We had dates. And usually two or three, four of us would team up to go to a dance at Joyland Park or have some activity in Georgetown. It was different in those days than what it is today. Yeah. But there was plenty of activities for us to keep us out of mischief, as that's
now, when you met your wife, was that in this time period?
No, it was not. I met a lot of fine gals, I realize that. But I always had in a vision of greater things, and I wanted to get out, and I wanted to get away, and I wanted to see what the world was like. I don't know why I always felt that way, but I did. And so I married my wife really after I got out of school. After I got out of college, after the Marine Corps, and I spent 7 years in the Marine Corps, and 3 years in the college, and a year or two bumming around. I was 32, 33 years old before I married.
Well, let's go to that point then. You graduated from school there in Scott County and then joined the Marine Corps.
About 8 months later, I joined the Marine Corps. Again, as I say, I had this vision out there that there was something over the hill, and I wanted to see what it was. I went to work in Georgetown. I worked for a hardware store, and I put in 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and drew $75 a month. Well, this didn't leave any money for me to see what was on the other side of that world out there, you see. And so I figured there had to be some way for me to do it. And we were walking down the street in Georgetown one day, a news editor, a newspaper writer, and myself, and it said, the sign pointed out, we need a few good men. that took it. We agreed that on Monday morning we'd go up to the post office and see what the guy said. Oh yeah, he'll take us because we were both big strapping young men, you know. We'd take you guys right away. Sent us to Cincinnati to go in, and he either faked, and I always will believe he faked, color blindness. And what they do to him, they send him back home. But where'd they send me? Paris Island, South Carolina. But I still thought I had the world by the tail until I got into Paris Island. And then's when the world come falling down for me.
Now, what kind of experience? Of course, the world was starting to be in a turmoil at the time. And I guess, the services were gearing up. What was that like? In the Marine Corps?
It's really hard to, as I think back over, it's difficult to describe what happened. You see, here's a young boy that never been out of the community, really, 19 years old, no money, no experiences, and they slapped me in with 66 other people gathered from Maine to Florida. That's all they'd take in for that company. Mm-hmm. And we got into Paris Island, and they had me in a roomette on a train. And boy, I thought they were going to really treat me great. And they dumped me in Paris Island along with 65 others. And the first thing they did is the drill instructor was standing there. And when he said, I'm your mother, I'm your life, I'm your eyes, I'm your nose, and you better believe it, and if you don't, we'll show you how in a few minutes. And they put us aboard a dump truck to take us into camp. And my first meal in the Marine Corps was beans and cornbread. And I just left that. I didn't want any more of that. But I had signed up for 4 years, and that's what they put me down to, was beans and cornbread. And I looked at that about three times and said, oh boy, you're in it. You better make the best of it. And so from that point on, I decided that I was going to be a good Marine. And I jumped into those beans and cornbread just like I'd never eaten one of them in my life. Yeah. It was a complete reversal of what I thought it was going to be like. It was just more of the hard work that I'd left on the farm, and much 10 times harder, because they said we need a few good men, and they admit even today that they're going to get rid of 10-15% because they can't take the work. Another 10% will fall out because of physical condition. And I've heard the commanding general of Parris Island say, if you gentlemen can tell me how we can get rid of 15% more of them, I'd like to know it, if you keep it legal. But yeah, we'd like to phase out about 40% of what we sign up. Well, that way we can keep a good, viable corps.
What was your service like during the war years?
Well, I went through all of it, of course. I was in Quantico. Mm-hmm. I had just finished aerial photography school. I went into photography in the Marine Corps. And I was in Quantico, and I wish I had made a movie of the Sergeant Major calling the squadron out on the tarmac at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and how he was in full dress with sword, mind you, and pulling that sword and throwing that sword in the air and pulling it back down the ground. It was most demonstrative. And then declaring, we're at war, conduct yourself accordingly. That's all he said. And 7 days later, we were on a train, bag and baggage, headed to San Diego. And we arrived in San Diego 14 days after war broke out. That's December the 7th. On December the 21st, we arrived in San Diego, North Island, San Diego. So from then on, it was in the South Pacific for me.
Yeah, you spent your service all my time
in either training aerial photographers in San Diego or in the South Pacific myself. We had two big squadrons, VMD squadrons. One of them was 254 and the other was 253. And I belonged to 254. Well, 253 got early call.
Yes, sir.
And then we relieved them on station. And we were just ready to go back into the South Pacific when war was ceased. So I had all of my experiences in the South Pacific.
You said you served 7 years in the Marines?
A little less than 7 years, yeah.
Was that that sound like, did you re-up? Or?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, I finished 4 years of service. Mm-hmm. I refused OCS school. If I had gone on and taken OCS school and become a lieutenant, you see,
uh-huh,
I could have gotten out within a day after the war was over. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be an aerial photographer because I really enjoyed that. The challenge is tremendous,
yeah,
to be an aerial photographer. It still is today.
Uh-huh.
I really wanted to do that, and so I refused OCS school. I was in the South Pacific on one of the islands when my 4 years was up, and it looked like it was going to go for another 4 or 5 years anyway, so I extended for 2 years. Because it meant a lot of money, I think $400 or $500 for extending 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I extended, and war was over within 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a year and a half to go on my sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And then just before I was discharged, I had an automobile wreck, and my left side of my face is all plastic surgery. And then when I went up for service, discharge, they found a spot on my lung. So all in all, I spent an extra year taking care of a physical problem that I had in San Diego.
Now, during that time period, was that when you were deciding that, well, when I get out, I'm going back to school?
No. When I got out, I told them my home base would be in Georgetown, Kentucky, and I returned to Georgetown. And during about a month's time in there, I decided that I'm either going to be a farmer, or I'm going to go into retail outlets, or I'm going to travel, or I'm going to go back to school. And it seemed to me that I needed a whole lot more education. So I went back to school,
mm-hmm,
and took general agriculture.
And you took general agriculture,
yeah,
at
UK.
At the University of Kentucky.
I spent 4 years at UK, well, 3 years, because I went through an accelerated rate, and then got a master's degree in agronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And soon after, I got out of school, I went into the certified seed program and worked there for a while, and then decided I'd like to be a county agent. And so I moved up here with Burt Collins here in Maysville, mm-hmm. and was a county agent with Burt for about 6 months. Okay. And they called me back into the state office.